Comparing Apples to Oranges. And I'm Mike, here with my guest host today,
Dave Gregg.
Thank you. All right, great. So we're going to go over what this podcast is. Dave, do you have any concept of what we're going to do?
You know, you've told me it's about comparing different things that are nominally related.
Yeah.
And, you know, exploring the synergy that comes therefrom.
Those were my words exactly, but I don't think that's not radio friendly. So we're going to look at two things that are in the same category that are not in the same genre. And then we're going to pit them against each other using four criteria that we came up with. And we'll decide which one is better. Our genre today, Dave, do you want to say it or do you want me to say it?
Yeah, so the genre today is solo artists who broke away from a group.
And we're talking about music today, so not like, you know, all the Renaissance painters and then like Leonardo da Vinci. Not that kind of artist.
Yeah, it's not like when da Vinci broke away from the other Ninja Turtles.
He would be the first one to do that. What a jerk. Yeah. Classic Raph move, but Leo would do it first.
It's a pretty rough move.
Let's go ahead and explore that a little bit.
You know, I think two general fact patterns jump to my mind. The first is when there's a group and there's discord within the group.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Whether it's Paul McCartney and John Lennon, I think, you know, they both broke away, but it was from kind of infighting. The other fact pattern that comes to my mind is the lead singer, the front man, who all of a sudden feels a bit too big for his britches and feels claustrophobic in the group environment and breaks free to try to make it on his or her own.
And then there's always going to be the exceptions, like your Dave Grohl's, where his band had to dissipate and he sort of just started rolling along. Did he ever have a solo career? I mean, he was in like six different things eventually.
You know, he drummed for the D.
Mm-hmm. He drummed for
Foo Fighters.
Queens of Stone Age.
Drummed for Queens of Stone Age.
I think was he in Eagles of Death Metal?
You know, I think we're thinking about this all wrong. In a lot of ways, Kurt Cobain is the one who really broke out of Nirvana.
That's too soon, man. They just released a documentary. Too soon. When we think about a band breaking up, we very rarely do we think that it's on positive terms. And almost always, you're going to think of the front man as somebody with too much of an ego. And so they're the ones who are breaking away. So not too familiar with the Police, but you can look at Sting for just half a second and understand why he went solo and they broke up. We're going to discuss that today. And we came up with four criteria. What makes a great solo act who breaks away from a group? Criteria one, we talked about the merits of that artist and their album in light of the group. So we're listening to the artist because we liked the original band.
You know, I think every breakout artist in some way fights to get out from under the shadow of, you know, the group they were a part of before. And I think that conception is well-founded because I think every artist that breaks away is compared to what they did and how they were in a group setting.
And some people try to cash in on that where they will actually, while in concert, sing some of the artists or some of the group's songs that got them popular, because typically they'd want to please their fan base while also trying to emerge triumphant from their former years.
I think it can be that, but it can be a bit of a fallback position.
Definitely.
You know, an artist will find themselves kind of thrust into the light and, you know, planning concerts where they have 30 singles as a group.
Right.
But 2 to 3 singles as a solo artist.
Right.
And then the breakout artist suddenly finds themselves in the kind of ironic position of trying to ride their former band's coattails,
mm-hmm.
which they've no doubt destroyed by leaving the band.
Criteria two, sort of same coin, different side. We're talking about how the solo artist and their work now distinguishes them from the original group. We understand that Beyonce definitely came from Destiny's Child, but she is now her own artist. What do you want to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, like Mike said, it's the same house, different mouse. So you have a situation where basically an artist, I think a valid metric is both how we view the artist in light of their group, but to be fair, this is an attempt at reinvention. This is an attempt to arise from a different set of ashes. And I think to be fair to the artist, we're also going to, you know, despite our instincts and knee jerks, to evaluate the artist independently, as if the former band had never existed.
Right.
Now, you may contend, and I may well agree, that that's bullshit,
right.
But I think, you know, we owe it to the audience to be objective as possible.
And then you'll occasionally get the people or the artists that will, the only way they feel comfortable distinguishing themselves is completely reinventing themselves. So I always think of Tom Morello as a good example because he was in Rage Against the Machine, like incredible electric guitar player. And when he went solo for the Night Watchman, he's like, you know what? I'm going to go acoustic and sing. And turns out, like, it was just terrible. Like, I understood what he was doing, and he did not have the chops for it, in my opinion.
Well, and I think that's same coin, different side. When an artist feels dictated
mm-hmm.
either to fall in line with their former group
right.
or outright rebel right. against the former group. And I think in either instance, what you often have is something that comes off to an audience as inauthentic.
Right. Or just bad. Like, I think he believed he was doing something, because the content of the songs, the spirit of the songs was similar to that of Rage Against the Machine. And I actually don't know how much of those songs he wrote, but I mean, the mentality was the same as just the performance. You're like, I think he was trying too hard to become...
Busta Rhymes.
No, I know his name too. It was like the guy who wrote a bunch of the songs about unions. Anyway, I'll look that up later. And it just flopped. So that falls in your face occasionally when you try to massively reinvent yourself. Because maybe you're just not good at it. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe there was a reason your band had a certain sound and maybe you were part of it. Which right. I think, you know, brings up another dynamic that we're kind of touching around here. Which is that a lot of times seeing the way an artist tries to define themselves or not define themselves or carry the torch of their prior band can be insight into what that person actually contributed to the former band.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they actually, you know, what cards they brought to the table. Because when you have an ensemble group, you know, I think our instinct is to think that the lead singer has written every piece of music and every word.
Very good.
But,
yeah.
you know, often that's not the case. And often, even if that is true, there's such severe and helpful editing and vetting and,
right.
you know, I don't think Paul McCartney or John Lennon ever wrote a word for the other, but they were there standing in the room shaking their heads when things sucked. And I think that culled a lot of crap
right.
out of the Beatles. And that's what made them so great and such a tight, consistently performing act, is they just had another ego in the room to live up to.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that segues really well into our third criteria, is we identified it as the cult of personality. So it's sort of, does this solo artist garner our attention, our interest? Sort of, do they have charisma on their own? Will they survive on their own just on their own merits rather than the coattails?
And, you know, I think there's two dynamics to cult of personality. There's how we think of the person and what breaking away from a successful group says about the person.
That makes sense.
I think having a viable group in the music business, but nonetheless thinking, yeah, these guys are holding me back, I should really get out of this, That's a spoonful of hubris.
Right.
You know, to even be there. And I think, you know, if you're going to make that determination and throw off the shackles and dead weight of your prior group, you better justify throwing your teammates under the bus like that. And so I think there is kind of a higher standard for solo acts versus solo acts that emerge from groups, because people that emerge from groups already had a place in the world and they're clawing for more. And I think they have to own, they have to earn that recognition in ways solo artists don't.
And not even talking about, you know, the politics and of studios and record labels, because I'm out of my element. I don't understand that stuff. But I could just say from a fan's perspective, if you're used to, you know, the energy on stage of a whole band, and that's what the audience is used to, and you're just up there by yourself, you have a lot more to bring, or you had better bring something that makes up for that lack of energy, that lack of... Because if you see a group interacting on stage, and, you know, whether they're, you know, it could be real, like if they get in an argument, or if they, like, play off each other, like, that's something that's a lot of fun as an audience member to watch. And if you're just up there by yourself, you know, maybe you have a drum machine or something, or, you know, you're playing an amp, you know, bass amp with your feet or something. I don't know what you're doing. But
you're basically that guy.
Yeah, you have
in
to
Branson
fill up.
With the drum on your back and the accordion.
The one-man band?
You're the one-man band, you know, and that guy's not getting my quarter, especially not if there's a guy dressed as a robot that can scare the shit out of someone if I give him a nickel.
You might be confusing Branson with, like, the Sunset Strip.
I've never been to either.
You've never been to Branson?
No, that Russian's there, and I don't.
Yakov Smirnov?
Yeah, I don't fuck with that guy. In Mother Russia, joke tells self. I mean, that's bullshit.
It's kind of over my head. And then our fourth criteria, we use this all the time, is re-listenability. This sort of ties in, did we like it? Did we enjoy it? Would we want to listen to it again? Would we recommend it to people? Just down to basics.
And I think re-listenability has got a lot of merit when we're talking about breakout acts. Because, you know, the stereotype is the lead singer shoots like shooting stars for half a second and then flames out.
Right.
You know, I think I have nothing at all to back this up. It's just a gut instinct I have. But I bet there are much less sophomore albums from artists that break away from solo groups.
Or in sort of Tom York's case, he tried to go out on his own. I think he did an album, and then Radiohead just got back together. And I don't know the backstory on that, but my money is on it was too weird, or it wasn't weird enough for the people who are like, you know what? I love Radiohead because it's weird. Tom York's on his own. It's going to be great. And then it just...
You know, there's a Simpsons episode about this. There's a Leave It to Beaver episode about this. You know, it's the kid gets huffy and runs away from home, and then he goes down to the fucking train yards with a little stick and a red handkerchief, and then he sees real hobos riding the rails, and he's like, all right, I actually had it pretty good back home. Then he comes back. I mean, I think that is also a very oft-recurring fat pattern.
So those are our four criteria. Next, we're going to discuss the two solo acts that broke away from a group. The two artists we picked for solo artists who broke away from a group. We have ASAP Rocky, who was part of the ASAP Mob. And so when you look him up, you could spell it both ways. You could spell A-S-A-P, or you could do $AP. Both are acceptable. However, when you try to search him in iTunes, if you don't put that dollar sign in, he will not show up. Fun fact about ASAP Rocky, if you try to look up Aesop, as in the guy who wrote Fables, and then Rock, who's also an artist, they Wikipedia will ask you to disambiguate. So I don't know who came first, but it's very confusing. Aesop Rock is not who we're talking about. We're talking about ASAP Rocky.
And he doesn't have any fables.
He's got a lot of stories, though. The freshman album we looked at from him was Long Live ASAP. He released an EP, which was Live Love ASAP. So the ASAP Mob is a group of rappers, producers, music video directors, fashion designers, and bikers. They also put out some music. They put out like two albums, and they were mostly like party rap, a little bit into the hip hop, but mostly just like club bangers they try to put out about, you know, doing drugs and how cool they are and how many women they sleep with.
You know, to my mind, the ASAP Mob, the only thing equivalent is that weird period where Andy Warhol was trying to turn his art form into a club vibe. And he was just populating everyone around him with, like, strange installation artists, with strange fashionistas, punk rockers. And there'd be, like, he decided that his art was this like collaborative vibe and how he could kind of cobble it together. I think that's the closest equivalent to the hip hop version of ASAP Mob.
And I agree with that in what ASAP Mob, because it currently still exists. I think that the delineation we're going to draw here is between ASAP Rocky is still part of the ASAP Mob, the collaboration, all those people who are still together, producing and working together. However, the group that performed and put out an album no longer makes music together in the same capacity, so that's how we're saying he broke away. Like, they're not a group that has broken up, and he was not a lead singer that drifted away from them. However, they do not make music as much as he does. He puts out more albums, puts out more EPs and singles, etc. I think that comparison you made makes a lot of sense. However, the group ASAP Mob is sort of like the Cash Money group, where it's like Lil Wayne and Drake and Nicki Minaj, where they just sort of all talk over each other on the same songs and that sort of stuff and rap about each other and the same stuff. And then they yell Cash Money, Young Money at the end. And so that's my musical take on ASAP Mob, but I liked your art collaboration analogy too. Do you want to talk about our second guy?
Yeah, so the other album that we're kind of trying to juxtapose with ASAP is Nate Roos and his debut album, The Grand Romantic. Now, Nate has kind of a troubled history in terms of deciding whether and for how long to play with other people. So Nate Roos, to my knowledge, first came on the scene in the band The Format. They put out two albums, I believe.
Right, and he formed it with one of his best friends, and that's what they literally said that. They didn't just say he formed it with people he knew. It was like, oh, it's his best friend that he formed The Format with.
And they put out, I think, two albums, Dog Problems and I Hope You're All Right. And, you know, they're pretty good albums. I mean, I really like them. You know, they kind of come off as maybe early Shins music, whether it's Shoots Too Narrow or Oh Inverted World. But really poppy, really peppy, a lot of spry in their step. Eventually, problems started to rise amongst the Format ranks. And out of that discord, The Format came to an end and Fun began. Now, Fun, that's lowercase F, lowercase U, lowercase N, period. Is a band, I think, maybe three or four summers ago, got a lot of attention and got a lot of critical adulation for their album, Some Nights.
Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I call it a draw. Some nights I wish that my lips could build a castle.
I believe it's their second album. I think their first album is Ready, Aim, Fire. Their second album, Some Nights, had We Are Young and also had a bevy of other material that kind of made them the self-designated artist of...
Wait, indie rock? Indie pop?
They were the summer anthem.
That's very... Yeah.
And I'd say an independent pop band. Anyway, as with The Format... Fun kind of went through a dry spell. There was talk about discord amongst the ranks. And Nate Roos emerged with a solo album,
which we're looking at today, called The Grand Romantic.
Yeah.
Released in 2015. And Long Live ASAP was released in 2013. Both gentlemen, Nate Roos, who I think is he heir to the Dr. Seuss family? And he just like... rejected the name so he could go out on his own.
I think it was originally One Fish Roost Fish.
That would be a drastically better album. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but that if there was more rhyming on this thing, I think I would have liked it more. Fun fact, Nate Roos is from Arizona. ASAP Rocky, whose real name is Rakim Mayers, who's apparently, when he produces stuff, he calls himself Lord Flocko. That's kind of cool. He's from Harlem, New York. And
is Flocko the Falcon in Star Fox?
No, it's Captain Flocko. No, not Lord Falco.
No, not Captain Falcon.
Yeah.
Falco is the fox.
Marconi?
Falco is the bird in Star Fox. All right.
Proceed. Anyway, okay, so we're going to look at these two gentlemen and delve into their histories a little bit to sort of see, because they are solo artists, we want to look at them as people. A little bit about ASAP. He has a rags-to-riches story where... he started rapping when he was 8. I don't know what that means. But his dad was in prison when he was 12, and his brother was killed when he was 13. That's really sad. Started selling pot and crack by the time he was 15 when he was moving around homeless shelters with his sister. And he joined the ASAP mob when he was 19. He ended up putting out his album in 2013, which was just a little bit after his dad died. And when you start listening to the album, it does not sound like something that the ASAP mob would put out. I mean, the very first song, Long Live ASAP, which is sort of an ironic title for how drastically different it is from that party scene that they rap about.
I wonder if they miss me. As long as I make history, now my soul is feeling empty. Tell a reaper, come and get me.
Who said you?
Like, oh, ASAP Rocky, that's, you know, it's probably going to be about doing drugs and hitting hoes and stuff, but it's very dark, and when I looked into it, it was like...
darker than hitting hoes.
Yeah, man. When they sing about that, that's pretty upbeat. He He quit selling drugs.
You can tell they're having fun doing it, and, even if it's dark subject matter.
He quit selling drugs and decided to focus on his rap career in May 2011. And you can sort of see why he went out on his own. It took A$AP Mob. They just kept putting off putting out an album. And when it finally came out, it sort of got some negative reviews. It was sort of cookie cutter.
Oh, it was universally panned.
Hip hop rap at the time. It was just sort of.
Who are those two guys that like? We like to party hardy. We like to party.
Hang on. Like LMFAO.
It was basically like an LMFAO rap album. I mean, obviously from, you know, Long Live A$AP, that's not where he was
right
mentally at the time or creatively at the time that album came out. And it was just this kind of bland LMFAO deep.
Problems. That's what you're thinking of?
Problems.
And you can sort of see that he wasn't particularly comfortable with, or maybe he didn't think the studio would be comfortable with how he's going to be portrayed as a solo artist. So he came out with some singles, and one's the song Problems, which I don't know why that was such a big radio hit, because even the title of the song has to be edited for them to even play it on radio. Bitches in my dime, taking hella long, bitch, give it to me now. Make that thing pop like it's in me over nine. Ooh, baby, like it raw with the shimmy shimmy yeah, huh? A$AP, get like me. But maybe that's what people like. They just like the idea that there's a bunch of cussing. I don't know. But anyway, that was a major hit. I mean, it had Drake on it, Kendrick Lamar, people who were blowing up at the time, who were still very popular in that scene. And it was, you know, talking about how I love bad bitches, that's my fucking problem. And yeah, I like the fuck, I got a fucking problem. If finding somebody real is your fucking problem, bring your girls to the crib, maybe we can solve it. You're like, oh, this, you know, that's how he hooks them. And then you listen to the album, you're like, this is some deep stuff for a guy, you know, who came out of the A$AP Mob.
I like Fucking Problems. Mm-hmm. I think it's a catchy song. I like
Kendrick. Oh, yeah.
I like Kendrick. But you can tell it was how he sold the album mm-hmm. to the record company. You know, it reminds me of, I don't know if this is true, but everyone talked about how Will Smith would come to studios with package movies to get the work done that he wanted to do. So he'd say, I'll do Hancock, mm-hmm. but you let me do Pursuit of Happiness. Or I'll do, what the fuck was the other one? I'll do I Am Legend, but then you have to let me do that movie.
After Earth where with the sun.
No, I wish. I think it was
Concussion.
It was the movie where like
Wild West 3.
Lost an organ and like it was 21 grams or 7 pounds.
And I know all his movies.
You know too many of his movies.
I think I've seen 5 of them.
And you can't even Independence sit through Day 2. Fucking Men in Black 2.
I did.
You don't even know which one it is. It was the bad guy.
The alien.
The alien. Yeah.
All right.
He's there, Trump.
And then getting political. Watch out, guys. That's a little bit about A$AP Rocky. Let's talk about Nate Ruess, heir to the Dr. Seuss franchise. So Dave gave you a little bit of his backstory. I don't know a lot about
I gave
about
you
his...
an exhaustive account of everything I know about Nate Ruess.
He did not grow up on the streets. I don't think he slung a rock in his life.
Yeah, but Breaking Bad was in Arizona, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, but like Southern Arizona. I don't know where it was.
You never been to Arizona. I had a layover in Phoenix once. It was a nightmare.
All right. Anyway.
He could have been in the mess.
My idea of why A$AP left, did his own stuff, is because he was more organized. He was, you know, he was less interested in the A$AP Mob mentality, in that they just wanted to produce certain kinds of music. Where Nate Ruess left Fun, apparently without telling anybody he was going to leave, because he fell in love. And he wrote a bunch of songs about being in love, and he didn't want the band to produce those songs. He wanted to do it on his own.
You know, Nate Ruess actually has a song he wrote for Format called I Love Being in Love, but he had no problem sharing that with the Format.
And that's the thing is, these songs could definitely be on a Fun album.
I think what's so frustrating, and I don't know if we're at the part where we just rip into Nate Ruess yet, but I think what I'd say is that my general vibe of Grand Romantic is it sounds like the B-sides from Some Nights.
I could see that,
like,
for sure.
Not only does it sound kind of like Fun, but it sounds like watered down Fun.
I mean, that goes directly back to he did not have the two other gentlemen to collaborate with or to say, hey, why don't we try this? Or
just someone to say, hey, the song sucks.
Yeah, I could
Sorry,
definitely.
It's not a good song.
I think you would have to walk on eggshells with this guy from what I'm getting, though. You'd have to pitch it as his idea to change his own song.
Well, because he'll reform at you if yeah. you fucking talk to him about it. I mean, and that's what's so frustrating about Nate Roos is like, you know, I think Nate Roos is genuinely capable of pretty compelling songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I liked a lot of stuff in the format. I don't think it's all that different from what came out of Fun. You know, Fun was definitely a louder sound on a broader scale. It was more mixed. There was more kind of adventurous use of harmonies and choral stuff.
Definitely.
You know, it was more, there was more pageantry in Fun albums, but it was fundamentally the same songwriting. Well, also, here's a side thing. You know, Pink's out of her fucking mind if she thinks, anybody thinks for a second, that Nate Roos didn't write that, you know, just give me a reason. Insert
Is that the Glitter
just
song?
Give me a reason.
I thought it was Glitter.
No, it was, so it was Nate Roos and Pink, and it's the, you know, we're not broken, just bent, we can learn to love again. Wonderful lyrics.
Are you sure that's not Glitter?
No, it's fucking Pink, and it's featuring Nate Roos. But here's the story, Pink. If you didn't write it, and you're one of two people singing it, then the song fucking features you, okay? It doesn't feature goddamn Nate Roos.
Nobody knew who Nate Roos... Nobody
no, it was,
still
it
knows
was,
who
it was
Nate
in the wake
Roos
of Fun. Yeah, so people knew Nate Roos as much as they were ever going to know Nate Roos at the time of that album. But, you know, my point is that Pink didn't write a word of that.
That's
she wrote as much of that as fucking Ben Affleck wrote a Good Will Hunting. But
that's over my head.
He didn't write a word. He wrote lying, apples. And then like he walked up there and took an award with Matt.
He came into his own. All right. I'm getting ahead of myself. All right.
It doesn't matter. The point is you can see a thread of songwriting between format,
right,
between Fun, and between Nate Roos's solo career.
Okay.
And it's clear that what seems to be the difference between good music and bad music is basically someone there to check Nate. Someone there to say, this sucks, this is good, play this up, downplay this. When I say B-sides of Fun albums, I don't just mean shittier Fun songs.
Right.
I mean it sounds like unrestrained Fun songs. They sound like unedited
Unfiltered,
Fun songs.
Right.
Like they were never like pushed all the way to, you know, final album quality. And, you know, fuck Pink, you know? She didn't write it, you know?
So much anger.
I'm not here for your independence.
Wait, you know, she wrote that?
Yeah. She, okay. Because it's fucking garbage. That's how I know she wrote it.
I don't think Pink was writing songs for you.
No, well, but she was when she was like, I knew this was going to happen. We're going to talk about Pink more than I wanted to. So, like, early Pink is great, though. Like, early Pink, was it Camp, like, Don't Know Love or Can't Buy Love, or when she had the sunglasses and the short, actually fucking pink hair, and she was like, you know, Shorty got a job, Shorty got a car, Shorty can pay her own rent. I mean, that's a fucking good song. And that was to me. Yeah, that's the thing, is there's like this discord between early good quality Pink and this like, spill your drink on me, go fuck you, Pink.
She's,
I mean,
she's got people to sing for now. That's the issue. She has an anthem.
Well, and the audience ruined her.
All right, we're going to look at the four criteria. No, that's just, that conversation, we got to transition.
No,
now.
I know. I like
Okay, so we're going to look at these two albums, how they stack up against our four criteria. So let's, which criteria do you want to talk about first, Dave?
Let's talk about...
Criterion?
Singular? Let's talk about the criterion of distinguishing oneself from the former group and or act.
Okay, we sort of touched on this a little bit, so let's talk about Nate Roos. We'll come up with some examples on how he did or did not distinguish himself from Fun, lowercase Fun with a period. So, I don't know if you know this, every time I looked up anything on Fun, the people who were writing, I don't know if they're, if Fun has just the best publicist or whatever, but every time Fun was lowercase, there was a period, and whenever they had to, you know, use the possessive form, it was lowercase Fun, period, apostrophe S. And I'm like, that is an editing nightmare.
That is undoing so many autocorrects.
Because you know those guys don't type. They just, like, speak into a microphone.
Yeah, they,
and
they have
they
a
use
dragon
that
dragon.
Yeah, dragon speech.
Dragon fire.
That's Nate Roos. I thought with the whole, the very first song, Aha, it starts off with a bang. It's sort of like a maniacal laughter sort of thing. It's catchy. The sound is different. It's almost like a rock song.
Last you falling on the floor, headed for the door, went straight to Philadelphia. Oh no, what have I begun? Call my mother, said I...
And then he comes in and it's like strong vocals, sort of creative lyrics. And then we get to which is apparently called pre-chorus.
Before we get to pre-chorus, I want to back up because Aha is in fact not the first track of Grand Romantic.
Oh, you got me.
Just like Some with Nights. Some Nights.
Okay.
It's almost like both albums are trying to approximate an orchestra warming up.
Yeah.
You know, where there's like all these sounds that will kind of come out later. You know, there's people going through scales.
Right.
There's a lot of cacophonic sounds that then kind of silence and then the first track.
Right.
And
that's true.
And, you know, I think one of the things when I expected to review Grand Romantic for the ways in which it drafted off the success of prior Fun albums, I didn't think I was going to have to work very hard to come up with ways I thought outright mimicked.
Definitely.
But it does, like, in a lot of ways, have, like, absolute fingerprints of Fun on it. And I think that's also true. I believe it's Aha, or it's the second song, has the line, there's kind of like a lull, and then between a build-up, it's almost like a bridge, there's the lyric, I think it's best we kept our distance. That occurs as a bridge in Some Nights by Fun, and end, I believe, either Aha or Nothing Without Love. I mean, it's the same lyric used in the exact same way.
Right.
One by a solo artist and one by Fun. It's almost like Nate had this idea, but Fun didn't use it the way he wanted to, and he got outvoted. So he's like, I'll show you.
Right.
I'm going to use this the way it should be used in the exact same way on the next album.
Or, you know, you could always argue, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, that's a pretty solid argument for music, right?
I mean, you know, I think...
That's what sampling's all about, right?
I think if it ain't broke, don't fix it is what Nate Roos said to himself every morning before he recorded this album.
What Dave's highlighting is what I was building up to when I'm like, oh, Aha, it's definitely a distinguished sound. And then it gets to the pre-chorus, which that's not... That doesn't belong in a song. It's just a really long chorus, right? So anyway, this is a personal thing that I don't enjoy is when an artist... They'll be singing, and then they will have a dialogue track. And I had to look it up because they wouldn't put this in the lyrics anywhere. It was him spoken word quoting an E.E. Cummings poem.
Oh, my God.
And I was not a huge fan of that.
I just had such a vile taste in my mouth. I did not do that kind of legwork to look up what he was fucking quoting. It's
because
an E.E. Cummings poem.
Because I kept hearing what he was saying, and it was about the rain and how it has the smallest hands.
It's for the best you didn't listen. It's for the best we get our distance. Oh, it's for the best you didn't listen.
Nobody, not
it's
even the rain.
And I said,
like,
well,
Donald Trump.
That's just a bunch of gibberish. I'm going to try and figure out. I'm like, maybe I misheard it. And then I had to find it. It was one of the comments. Like ABC lyrics thing, because the lyrics wouldn't put it. And I think that's a Nate Roos at work, his publicist, that guy who made them do the period and the apostrophe when they spelled Fun. Because why would you go to the trouble of, and he does it twice, it's part of the pre-chorus, like you're gonna hear him say the same thing. And so Aha, which I thought was gonna be his most distinguished song, turned out to be, it sort of stabbed itself in the back.
Well, and I
shot itself in the leg.
I
rather.
Think Fun, F-U-N period, and just the editing headache that deciding to like name your band that like entails,
right?
And like the headache that will never fall on you but will fall on the poor schmuck that's drafting your press releases,
right?
Coupled with this new knowledge I'm now hearing is that he's spoken words in E.E. Cummings poem over Aha. I mean, this bleeds a little bit into Cult of Personality, but Nate doesn't strike me as a particularly easy guy to work with. I think he has a...
Because he, like, quits working with you and disappears.
Well, I think that. Even, I think when he quits is the best part, probably. But
yeah.
I think he probably has an overzealous sense of, and I'm trying to say this word so that you can tell I'm saying it with italics, brand. Like, I just think he has a very meticulous self-crafted idea of what it means to be Nate Roos, mm-hmm. and why Fun yes. needed Nate Roos and didn't respect him properly, just like the format needed Nate Roos and didn't respect him properly, and just like that bitch Pink needed Nate Roos and didn't respect him properly. How can it feature me?
You can catch Dave's other podcast, IHatePink.com.
No, I, the thing is, I love Early Pink. Oh, we're back to Pink again. I love Early Pink.
We've never left. You just were, like, just, waiting quietly to talk Pink, about Pink.
She didn't write that song. It's not like anything else. Never mind.
I don't know why you're purporting that she's convincing people she did. Like, I
it's on her. It's on her album, and yeah. it says Pink featuring Nate Roos.
That's just how you put stuff.
But I think Nate Roos wrote it, and I think there's a lot of gall. If someone wrote the song mm-hmm. and sings on the song, then the song features you.
Okay, but I think this is something you could bring up in your Pink chat rooms instead of...
No.
Now.
That's not what I talk about in the Pink chat rooms.
Anyway. So, also, I just want to bring up how I think he just, like, Nate Roos was like, I'm going to make a song called Harsh Light. And I'm going to have the choruses, We All Got Scars. And I think in his mind, that was him smacking the face of We Are Young. Where really it was he just replaced the lyrics, because instead of, you know, we are young, we're full of life, we all got scars. And then he has another song that's it's only gonna get worse from here. And
it's when it only gets much worse, it only gets much worse.
He was trying too hard. Clicked Control R. Is that the one you do for replace? Control Find. Mac.
I
anyway.
Have Control Z in it. But you just, it's just Command. It's not Control, but it's still the same letters.
Okay, so Command R, and then he just replaced all, like, the chorus for We Are Young with We All Have Scars. And I don't think changing the message is that drastic of a distinguishment.
I just have this idea that, like, Nate Roos's view on format and the format and Fun are they kept him from being true Nate Roos. And so I think Mike's right that not only does Grand Romantic seem to be trying to directly harness and recreate the strengths of prior format and Fun albums, but it almost like he's trying to reinvent them in his own image.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's attempting to, you know, ride the coattails of prior efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of artists do that, whether they break out of shells or not. But, you know, he's kind of trying to, like, recolonize his own past with Grand Romantic. And it just comes off as someone staring into the mirror, repeating to themselves that they are loved.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not sure I love Nate after this.
Yeah. So let's talk about A$AP Rocky and how he distinguishes himself on this album.
Night and day compared to... in A$AP my opinion. Mob. Well, night and day compared to A$AP Mob, which also means it's night and day as compared to how, like, he approached breaking away
right.
to Nate Roos as well.
I could see that. I'm going to bring up just a couple of the songs. He does a song with Skrillex, or Skrillex produces it. He's in the music video, which is terrible music video, because that's a party song. Like, that and Problems are the party songs on this album, which I think are sort of his nod towards the execs that get him in there. But within the song for Wild for the Night, he talks about the attitude of him as a rapper who gets drunk and stuff.
Drunk and disrespectful, calling women bitches. I don't mean no harm, but won't you win your friends? Meet us in the cut and we'll give you the business.
Such a hilarious line for me, because he's like,
Wild for the night, fuck being polite, I'm going.
It's so aware of itself that I can't think he's being ironic. Like, he's in his mind, he's like, I'm gonna go wild for the night, and I'm not gonna be very nice. And he's aware of that, and for some reason that endears him to me so much.
You know, I think when we talk about A$AP, I think A$AP, I keep towing the line with the Fable guy. So when we talk about ASAP, I think when we first started this podcast, we talked about kind of the fact patterns that give rise to breakout artists. I think another way of saying it is someone who breaks away from a group almost always thinks that they can do better than what the group is doing. All breakaways are subjectively kind of the same thing, but objectively they're not, because sometimes someone really does have a voice that needs to be heard and sometimes they don't. I don't think Nate Roos has a voice independent of Fun or the format that needed to be heard in such a way that warranted the Grand Romantic. I think ASAP does. I mean, I think our discussion about how ASAP, he was kind of made to wear a clown costume in the mob recordings, you know, it reminds me of LMFAO, which I can't imagine a worse hell than having to act like you're into the vibe of LMFAO just when you're not. And sometimes you're not. If you got dark stuff to say, say dark stuff, you know. I think, let's talk about Destiny's Child and Beyonce. Like, at a certain point, Beyonce's kind of like, I'm putting down the sickest verses on Bootylicious. I'm getting outvoted 2-1 on this knucklehead stuff like Charlie's Angels. And I got other stuff to say. And I can't say it in this environment because the tone that this group has created is either, you know, just an anathema to or stifling of me kind of finding this kind of voice. And I think there's no way some of these tracks by ASAP could have occurred in something put out by ASAP Mob.
This is an easy generalization.
Well, and to follow the point, I think it's also the case that, you know, Lemonade never could have come out under Destiny's Child.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, and I think maybe that's a good rubric, is that I could see any of these Grand Romantic songs coming out under Fun, but I couldn't see quite a bit of the material of ASAP Rocky on Long Live ASAP coming out in kind of his former group.
I think two things to that. I don't even think Single Ladies could have come out from Destiny's Child. You know, even though it's a group of single ladies, I don't think...
Are they single?
What am I? What am I?
You'd know.
Their biographer?
You'd know. You have their pillow.
I gave one to you. I stole it back, so now I have two. I don't have a lot to say about Fun because I didn't listen to them, but so there's a couple songs where ASAP Rocky has people featured on the song, but I think one of the best tracks on
there... Not Pink featured.
Oh, God. That was my bad. Sorry, team. But the song One Train, where he has just a group of up-and-coming rappers sort of take a verse, I don't think that could have come out from ASAP Mob. And that's literally a mob of rappers that would all take a verse. And it's just the precedent set, the direction set by the person who sets it up. And I think ASAP said, this is what I want to say. This is important to me. I'm going to invite people that I enjoy listening to, but also who I think can talk about something important.
I do like that ASAP did that. And I think, you know, that kind of participates in a broader trend in hip hop where the group comes after the solo artist, and the group is a way to kind of bring up other like-minded or in the main act's mind undervalued artists. I mean, you think of Nelly breaks out and then comes the Saint Lunatics.
Okay.
Eminem breaks out, then comes D12. Nas breaks out, then comes The Firm. Like, there's kind of a mechanism in rap where one of the main ways you collaborate is this kind of rising tide lifts all boats kind of mentality, where you surround yourself with kind of no names that you think have merit and you hope they get lifted up, which really is kind of the exact opposite of breaking away. It's trying to share in success. And I think that track for ASAP is kind of a knee-jerk reaction to ASAP Mob, where, you know, he didn't feel lifted. He didn't feel creatively nurtured. I'm sure ASAP would never use that phrase. But, you know, he didn't. I mean, clearly he had things to say
that
had no place in ASAP Mob.
He was also more organized, more motivated to put out his music, where I think they released their mixtape as free to download, which I'm not arguing is a bad idea. It just seems sort of less ambitious than ASAP Rocky would.
Well, and I think ASAP Mob released it as a mixtape in part because that was a good excuse for why, like, the production value was so kind of crummy.
That's fair too.
I mean, I think a lot of hip hop groups, when they want to get something out quickly without producing it properly, they'll do it under the guise of a mixtape. You know, it's like, oh, it's so rushed. What were you looking for?
And I think this isn't really an argument, but sort of a caveat with your idea about hip-hop artists for Public Enemy. When Chuck D brought Flava Flava along, he needed a hype man. He was aware of his own strengths, and he identified that crazy guy who he's going to bring more energy than should be allowable. I think that's what Aesop Rocky did on some of his tracks. He said, this is what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to bring Drake in on this because people think he's really cool right now. And when there's a part in Problems when Drake has to say almost sorry because he almost drops the beat.
Word, ain't heard my album, who you sleeping on? You should print the lyrics out and have a fucking read along. Ain't a fucking sing along unless you brought the weed along. And just, okay, I got it. And just drop.
I don't even think he's freestyling. I think he was reading off of a piece of paper and he either went too fast or forgot to write something in. And he like sort of laughs and then he catches it at the end. Oh, poor guy.
You know, like,
sort of out of your league.
I have two things to say. You know, it reminds me whenever when Eminem was first like getting off the ground and Dr. Dre was trying to like lift him up in this kind of similar collaborative way.
That's almost like a sensei.
Well, it is. But what's so funny is that like Dre and Snoop are kind of like doing this bang this in the club kind of rap.
Right.
And then like Eminem gets on, he's like, and I'm gonna kill my wife. Like he just like, he, like they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Like,
this is about the club, Em.
You were gonna be like, the white Chuck. You were gonna be the white Flava Flav, yeah. And you put it in a weird direction.
Everything you do is about killing your wife. I don't know if we can make this work for song after song. That's all that
he's
you rap.
Like, but, I can talk about my mom, and they're like, yeah. We're good.
Is it killing your mom? Yes, of course it is. I'm me.
He's like, but, that's what you wanted.
But the other thing that Mike's comments make me think of is, I'm going to make a bold claim here. I think Wu-Tang Clan is the Dread Pirate Roberts of this model. And that the Wu-Tang Clan has had such a rolling membership. It's not like a group that seeks to lift up little-known artists.
Right.
They just bring people into the fold. It's like an elevator. You get on Wu-Tang Clan.
You rise up
and you step out Ghostface. You step out Raekwon. You step out Kill a Priest.
I like how you didn't reference the RZA because I think he should still be on the elevator. He's not. He keeps trying to get out on the wrong floor.
He's not done yet. He's half-baked. But the idea that, you know, it's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. Like, you step into the shoes and you're that for a while. Mm-hmm. And then someone else steps in.
And I think that's why they have staying power, is because they're aware of that. They've never broken up. Wu-Tang is forever because they want to exist.
I just want to say that when Mike said Wu-Tang is forever, I instinctively joined my hands to make a W. I could not. That was almost like a tear. Like, Wu-Tang is forever, you know? It's bigger than us all. It's bigger than ODB.
R.I.P. And then let's talk about, oh god, we're only on the second criteria. Okay, so clearly that one went to ASAP. So...
I don't know.
Just because we spent...
Seemed pretty close.
Dave's going to say this one went to Pink, and I'm going to punch him right in the face.
None of it goes to Pink. Write your own damn song.
So our second criteria for solo artists who came from a group is they have merits in light of the groups. We recognize that they are important because they came from a group, and that still influenced our appreciation of their work.
I think, you know, in an effort to be kind of objective, you know, it's kind of a fiction that we could ever interpret an artist separate and apart from, you know, their history, especially their prior musical history. In the interest of being objective, let's take Grand Romantic on its face. Let's take Long Live ASAP on its face and just pretend, you know, Fun in the Format never existed and ASAP Mob never existed. You know, just which one's the better album? I think we spent a lot of time on the first criteria because I think a lot of those issues sprawl into this category as well.
Definitely.
I think I can just say, like, as just a pure matter of aesthetics, I mean, Long Live ASAP. I mean...
You're doing re-listenability. We're talking about the merits of the group.
Okay.
So we'll get to that.
Okay.
We're going to articulate that as, would the fan base of the original group enjoy this album by the solo act? Let's talk about Nate Roos. We've sort of laid into him... This is sort of Fun light. I would think that the fan base of Fun would love this album.
I guess what I'd say is, if anyone would love this album, it would have to be the fan base of Fun.
What about, I think Nate Roos likes it a lot. He likes it a
You're
lot.
You're insane if you don't think Nate Roos is like the primary fan base of Fun.
He's like, I wrote it for me because I'm in love.
I like Fun, but it's not Nate Roos-y enough.
Very Dr. Seuss of thing to him to say. So the song Great Big Storm, I thought it was just Some Nights, and...
lost in this maze, losing love, losing friends, losing faith in chemicals, afraid one day you'll find me.
Like, I accidentally started listening to the wrong album. Like, all of it is the same, like, the crescendos.
Juxtaposition of, like, sweeping, like, you know, multiple overlay tracks, like, sound effects, kind of this trick that he does and that Some Nights uses constantly, which is, like, you know, basically taking the one voice and making 100 overdubs, like,
right,
a millisecond off, so that it sounds like it's a room full of people, like, chanting. I mean, that was used so often throughout this album. Like, you know, I don't think there's... Honestly, like, my conception of Nate Roos writing this album is he just kept half of the fun things to himself while they were writing Fun Nights, Some Nights. And, you know, he just absconded with it and said, I don't know why I'm splitting all these profits four ways. Although I'm sure he had, like, a stupidly exponentially higher, like, take on album sales.
I could see that.
As part of just his cult, but...
He didn't have a lot of time to mature as an artist, so, I mean, how different could the sound actually be?
And if the writing process is what we've kind of hypothesized, like I said, I feel like Nate Dutt did write the material for fun. I feel like he did write the material for Pink, and he also did write the material for the format. You know, I think what Nate needs is just to not be in charge creatively of his projects. I think he's a great songwriter. I do. I think none of that came through in this album because he had no... you know, guidance, no people getting in his face, no one saying, like, this is substandard or not.
He wasn't just challenged.
Yeah, he just threw things against the wall and said, I'm Nate Roos, so they'll stick.
What do you think about A$AP Rocky? Do you think A$AP Mob fans were fans of Long Live A$AP?
I think I can imagine there being some overlap, but not necessarily. I guess what I'd say is any fans shared between A$AP Mob and A$AP Rocky, I think would be incidental. Like, I don't think there's a direct line of, like, a carryover fan base between A$AP Mob and A$AP Rocky. So, you know, begrudgingly, I kind of give this category to Nate.
I agree. I don't necessarily think this is an awesome category to have won, but I understand why it's important, and I think that...
This is the daytime Emmy of the four.
I could see that. And A$AP Rocky probably got some people to listen because of his singles, and then the people that followed up, he either won new fans or they wouldn't have been interested anyway.
I think giving this category to Nate Roos isn't a slight against to A$AP because I don't think he was really trying to marshal the energy from the A$AP Mob collection, you know, and carrying it into this. Like, you know, I think, you know, he wanted this to be a break. He wanted there to be his life to be defined before this album and after this album. And I think as part of just probably the way he thought about this album, he realized that he'd have to kind of go get new fans, go culture a new vibe, and just kind of reinvent himself. And I think he did. Sometimes you have to lose one kind of nominal category to win substantively in other ones, and I think he has here.
And I think it's interesting that he's definitely still a rapper, still a hip-hop artist, and he didn't have to transcend too many barriers. And I think when he came out with this, it was... within the culture, it started to be acceptable for people to rap about things that were not just going to parties and just, you know, drinking cough syrup in your liquor.
Well, you know, and I made a joke earlier about, like, Eminem rapping about killing his wife and his mom. And
pretty good joke, by the way.
And people on the streets. But, you know, I do think, for better or worse, Eminem is one of the first people in my mind to have really mainstream popular rap that wasn't about, you know, typical rap hierarchies, which are, like, you know, money, bitches, gangster. I mean, like, you know, he basically just aired his domestic grievances in a hip-hop setting, independent of whether that was a good idea or whether it worked out for him. It did work out for him.
Creatively, but it was a good idea.
But independent of how he decided to break from the rap mold of subject matter, he paved a lot of the way for, you know, rappers putting stuff out there about their mental health, their thought conditions, their relationships, depression, comic book. I think Childish Gambino is a debt to Eminem. Maybe that's because there's a race dimension to that. I don't know, being a white rapper. But what I know is that he was one of the first rappers I can remember that didn't rap about rap things, whatever 13-year-old me thought that was.
You see that there's sort of a, not necessarily a cycle, but you'll see it in sort of a sine wave. Well, there'll be times where hip-hop started with people rapping about their lives on the street, and then it became, it was an insult to call somebody a studio rapper, and then there are legitimate rappers right now who talk about their time in the studio. And I think, I wouldn't say it's swinging the other way yet, but we're seeing stuff from Kendrick Lamar, and this stuff from A$AP Rocky. You see stuff from
Lupe Fiasco.
I mean, there's a whole list. You can think of the people who do this, and you know their name, but they are not in the public eye as much as the people who are still making music videos where women are shaking their enormous butts.
But they are popular in ways they weren't.
Definitely.
You know, it's growing. And I don't mean to say that Eminem was the first person to rap not about... I mean, NWA.
Right.
I mean, Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, clearly that there's a lot of pioneering kind of like very socially conscious rap groups. But in my life, when I first started listening to rap, and that's the only frame I can really speak about with any kind of like scope or knowledge of the culture, is when I just first started paying
your
attention.
Experience.
Like, Eminem was the first person in my mind that didn't rap about rap things. And that was the first entrance in the popular culture in, let's call it, wave two of hip hop.
Definitely.
I think a lot of territory has been reclaimed through the door Eminem opened.
And our third criteria is cult of personality. How much charisma do you think the solo act has independent of the group? Let's talk about good old Nate. Natey Nate.
Nate Dogg. You know, I don't know. It's really tough for me because on the deeper cuts of the format and fun, you know, the tracks are so kind of like unflinchingly personal. And even the popular tracks from the format in Some Nights, even Some Nights itself, even We Are Young, they're very personal songs. And I don't think I've ever associated the intimacy with anyone other than Nate Roos.
Okay.
So I think he's finally got his name on the billboard in ways it wasn't before. But in terms of cult of personality, I'm not sure the other members of Fun and the format were anything more than a check and a mechanism to channel Nate Roos. And now he's just kind of unbridled. So I'm not sure I think that Nate has taken any real meaningful steps in terms of cult of personality away from what he had had as a member of Fun and Format.
Sort of, I don't think he has enough musical chops, and he definitely doesn't have enough interesting material or mature material to go out on his own and expect us to view this as anything,
you know,
but a side project.
When we saw Nate Roos at Summerfest, mm-hmm. you know, it was, I mean, I heard Guy from Fun
mm-hmm.
1,000 times. And, you know, I bet if A$AP, and I wish he would have, played at Summerfest, at Lou Fest,
yeah.
it wouldn't have been Guy from A$AP Mob.
Right, exactly. And I think, so lending into that, A$AP Rocky, he garnered a lot of people onto this that I don't think would have been comfortable singing with A$AP Mob. And I mean, he sung with Lana Del Rey. He brought in Florence Welch on. He's got, you know, Schoolboy Q. He probably would have done something. Kendrick Lamar. He got some names of people who you're not going to, oh, 2 Chainz. He's sort of a 2 Chainz and Skrillex. That I think they would do with songs with anybody. But I think that he's just bringing up what he wants to hear. And I think people are responding to that because they want to hear that too. Or maybe they didn't know that and then they heard it and they're like, this is, I enjoy this too. I think the person he is projecting in his songs is somebody that we want to know more about and we want to listen to.
And it's someone we didn't get a peek at in the A$AP Mob material. You know, I actually, and this was unintentional, but I really think A$AP and Nate Roos are really good foils for one another, because if I'm looking at it, I'd say the only thing that changed is the name for Nate Roos.
Yes.
You know, the format became Fun, became Nate Roos. But with you know, A$AP Rocky, I'd say the only thing that didn't change was the moniker A$AP.
Right.
You know, everything else has been, you know, I think wildly revamped. I think one of the reasons A$AP struck from A$AP Mob is because he didn't have control. And now clearly, I mean, he's the captain of his own ship, and it shows. I mean, there's things that he's interested in that we're hearing about that just would have never seen the light of day under A$AP Mob.
I think it's interesting that in some of his music videos, well, first of all, that he kept the name A$AP and that he's still interested in associating with them. And I don't think it's, he signed a contract so he has to. I think he did that on purpose. all of his albums have the word ASAP in it. I don't think it's a reference to his own,
yeah,
his own,
I mean,
name.
He hasn't just like kept his old name for branding purposes. He's affirmatively shoved ASAP into each thing he's put out.
That's where he's from, but he's still a creative influence in the actual, the mob, as in the art makers. Okay, so I think Cold Personality, that one went to ASAP. Okay, let's talk about re-listenability. Which album did you want to recommend to people? Would you listen to, how many times did you listen to both albums? Just for the purposes,
I mean,
of this.
And it's, you know, the only telling thing is that I listened to Grand Romantic once before we undertook the project of this podcast, and I listened to it once after we undertook the project of this podcast. I would not have listened to it a second time if not for this podcast. That being said, I've listened to Long Live ASAP, I believe, three times all the way through, and all three were before I was called to participate in this podcast. You know, I can manufacture an answer, but those numbers, I think, speak for themselves. Like, I was willing to listen to ASAP multiple times without a reason, and I was unwilling to listen to Grand Romantic a second time without a reason.
I don't think I'd feel comfortable telling someone to listen to Nate Roos unless I knew they were a Fun fan. And if they were a Fun fan, I'd just be like, just listen to Some Nights. And then, like,
well, that's
maybe I'm Nothing Without Love, because that's, you know, that's a pretty good song. I think
I'm a Fun fan, and I'd say, you know, don't listen to Nate Roos. I mean, I'm a Format fan, and I'd say, you know, I'd say I'm a Format fan, but you can find some good stuff in Fun, but I'd steer clear of that solo project.
Right. ASAP brings in a lot of stuff that you would recognize as popular rap, popular hip hop, and I think that would get a lot of people. And then those lyrics just bring you in. You're interested. And it's not just because he's talking about how he used to be poor, or the lifestyle that he escaped.
Religion. I seen the clothes was missing. Catch you slipping, then it's Christmas. Motherfucker wish list. My ghetto was ambition for my binges and my Bentley and them bitches. Now I get on the road.
He's doing a good job of telling a story. Really enjoyed that. Re-listenability goes to ASAP. Before we tell you who won, because we know you're not keeping score at home, we're going to tell you our favorite and least favorite songs from both albums. Which album do you want to talk about first, Dave?
Let's do Grand Romantic.
All right. So my favorite track off of that was Take It Back. It featured a guitar solo from Wilco's Jeff Tweedy. That is not the reason I picked that song, and actually, after I found that out, I'm like, oh man, could we get this any more pretentious? It's like, hey, let's talk about Wilco, which is so self-involved, and that's not true. I think their fans are worse than Wilco's image, and I think that if you bring in Jeff Tweedy on an album, you're like, oh, just to play a guitar solo. He's a good singer. You can't bring him in for that or anything.
Your eyes don't look close to mine. Lonely times and the people the same. You see what you've been and you mean what you say and you say what it is.
I really enjoyed that song. I thought it had a good pace.
I mean, I like Wilco as well, but I would agree with Mike's sentiments that it's strange to bring in someone for a guitar solo who's not a guitar virtuoso,
right,
and not regarded as such by anyone, including himself.
Okay, so that was I thought that was my favorite song. I thought it sort of stood out. What's your favorite song off of Grand Romantic?
I'd say my favorite song off of Grand Romantic is Moment.
Okay.
It's track number 8.
Well, I'm fine. I just need a moment. I'm all right.
One of my favorite things about the deep cuts of Format are Fun albums. In particular, Ready, Aim, and Ignite from Fun and Dog Problems from the Format is there's these very kind of personal, meandering, little autobiographical songs that are kind of delicate little flowers that are just kind of nice summer night driving songs. Mm-hmm. And I thought those are the songs where I think maybe Nate Roos needs the least direction. I think when he starts writing beyond these little ditties and starts getting into grand pageantry and orchestral movements, that's where he really starts to lose himself and needs someone kind of reining him in. But I thought Moment was a callback to some of my favorite songs under fun in format that would, you know, they're just kind of sweet, and they're just like songs that you don't mind having in the background, either to not pay attention to, but if you pay attention to them, they hold up the snuff.
Least favorite song for me, it was Bright Side. It's not just because the lyrics seemed a little trite to me.
Never meant to set the world on fire. Just wanted something you'd remember me by.
There's this really weird thing he does at the end where he's singing in a ridiculous falsetto.
And look at you! And look at you!
And he's saying, oh, look at you! And it seems sort of, it reminded me of the scene in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Willy Wonka, when they're floating up because of the bubbles, and for some reason it infuriated me, and I can't verbalize why.
So I'm actually going to chime in on this point and say Brightside was also my least favorite
song.
No
way! That's great.
You know, it was clearly at the end for a reason.
Right.
It was clearly assuming no one was listening at that point. Mike's accurately covered my displeasure with Brightside. I would like to drift into a dishonorable mention.
Absolutely.
And that is You Light My Fire, which I think is a straight rip off the Doors.
And you light my fire. Ooh.
Ooh. Basically, and I'm sure in his mind, he equates himself to Jim Morrison and the Doors when he thinks about himself in fun. These people are just holding me back. Jim Morrison had a nasty habit of reading poetry over his songs. There's just enough there that makes me think he's trying to intentionally reference Come On Baby Light My Fire. And yeah. I just want to say, you, sir, are no Jim Morrison.
We're not going to light your fire. Or we're going to light it and then put you on top of it, because just don't do that, man. Let's talk about our favorite and least favorite song from A$AP Rocky. I want to start with our least favorite so we can end on a strong note. So what's your least favorite song from A$AP Rocky? Did I catch you off guard?
It did.
Okay, sorry. I'll go first then. My least favorite song from A$AP Rocky's Long Live A$AP was Fashion Killa. And it's not because it's a bad song. It didn't ring true with the rest of the songs, and it was too poppy for me.
She got a lot of Prada, that Dolce and Gabbana. I can't forget Escada and that Balenciaga. I'm sipping purple syrup, come be my Aunt Jemima. And if you is a rider, we go shopping like manana.
It sort of reminded me of Flashing Lights from Kanye, which I really like that song. I just think this one was out of place. It seemed sort of too, not exactly experimental, but A$AP was delving and stuff that he hadn't mastered yet. And I just thought he did such a good job with the other formats that I didn't think he mastered this one. Plus, it was really weird when spent so much time talking about how the lifestyle was damaging of rich millionaire who makes his money on rapping. And then he lists a whole bunch of fashion designers' clothes. So that sort of just rubbed me the wrong way, I think.
So for me, the track is Ghetto Symphony. I think we talked about two kinds of songs on this album, and it makes sense given that this is kind of his breakout effort. But there are songs that were kind of true to where A$AP was at the time he wrote this album, and that there were songs that he clearly used to dangle in front of record execs to get the album sold.
Riding on my enemies is my ghetto symphony. Ne?
I think Fucking Problems is one of them, but is nonetheless a damn good song.
Right.
But I think Ghetto Symphony is a similar offering that just isn't as strong. So not only do I not love what it's trying to do, I don't think it's doing it that well.
So my favorite song off of Long Live A$AP was One Train. Sort of went over this already. It had Kendrick Lamar.
Let's play ball in a ballpark with all sharks in a blindfold. I rhyme cold, my K hot, yo nine cold. They bark like K9 drone, that banana clip. Straight from the rip, I'll make that shirt say rip. I'm on some shit, if I'm not the hottest, then hell must have froze over. You thought it was safe, then forgot what the...
Had some other their artists.
Ain't never been no rapper this cold since Tupac was frozen. Thawed out for a spot date in a Coachella show, yellow wool.
We a different color like a hood, red bra and panties. And my phone be over hat like pots and pans and pantries. Anti-cosm high like Michael Jackson, panty loafers. Moonwalking on the sun, barefoot with shades on. Bitch pussy smell like a...
Anyway, it had a bunch of current hip-hop artists on there, and they sort of got to do their own thing, and there was a lot of interesting stuff they had to say, and it's not the typical talking about how cool they are, how much money they have, what they're spending it on. And A$AP Rocky had something to say. He said, I wanted to make a posse cut that felt like an original 90s underground track. I don't know very much about independent underground 90s rap, but I thought this song...
I think you do, but go ahead.
I don't purport to know a lot about it. Can I say that?
We're white. We definitely don't purport to know about it.
That's fair. What I liked about it was that everybody got to say something. They built off of each other without stepping on each other's feet. And it was all on subjects that seemed they had good experience in, rather than they were just talking about how cool their lives were.
I agree with Mike's sentiments. My favorite track actually on this album was Goldie.
Oh, that's a good one.
You know, I think Goldie is the song where, and it may have been Hit Boy, but whoever mixed that album knew how to mix it. That was the first time I felt the mixing and ASAP's laid-back style were finally on the same page. And I think they got off the same page later on in the album and came back together briefly at other points. But I think whoever mixed Goldie, one, the little chant stuff is just like,
till you don't, till you get Glock jaw. Party like a cowboy or a rock star. Everybody play the tough guy to shit pop off.
Cause you don't think...
Cryptic as fuck. It's awesome.
Especially cause auto-tune, I just didn't think it would be that good, but they do an awesome job with it on this.
But there's a real kind of like... laid back, I don't have to lean forward in my chair to say fuck you,
right,
kind of vibe to Goldie that's really come to epitomize, and I think set the tone for how other people have mixed subsequent albums by ASAP. And I just thought that was where the artist and the producer just hit their stride, was Goldie.
Tell me, do a stink. It feel good waking up some money in the bank. Three model bitches, cocaine on the sink. And I'm so body, I might roll up in the tank. Cause my chain came from Cuba, got a lock up on the link. And the red bottom loaf is just to compliment the mink. I shank.
Also, it didn't feature anybody talking over the song, quoting E.E. Cummings.
Yeah.
Which... I just want to put it out there.
What's the line from Childish Gambino?
Oh.
E.E. coming on your face. Now that's poetry in motion.
I think what's important is that we're just going to throw out, we don't dislike E.E. Cummings. We just don't like people that quote it verbally on their own songs. I think that's dumb.
I mean, I think we just generally don't like people that try to tie themselves to like greats instead of producing their own material, whether it's Jim Morrison, E.E. Cummings, or just Nate Roos trying to tie himself to his former sense of self.
Yeah. As heir of the Dr. Seuss franchise.
Yeah.
He's going to cash in on all that. What's the elephant's name? Hubert?
Lorax or some shit? I don't know.
Anyway. Okay, so if you're keeping track at home, we came up with A$AP Rocky as the clear winner in solo artists who broke away from a group. 3-1 on the old criteria selection. Let's talk about recommendations for solo artists who came from a group. I'm going to go ahead and throw out that we can't say Paul McCartney, Beyonce, and Justin Timberlake. Is that okay with you?
Well, I think that's something we should have voiced before we started this podcast.
Ooh,
but that's fine.
Zing! Sorry, big guy.
That's fine. No big deal. No big deal.
Okay, you said I wasn't going to be happy with who you picked. Who'd you pick?
No, I was right. In fact, you outright barred my pick. I was going to say Beyonce.
All right.
What I'd say, though, is now that I can't say Beyonce.
You can say her.
I'll say Dr. Fraser Crane.
Why did I know you were going to say Fraser?
Because you fucking canceled Beyonce.
Can you tell me why Beyonce should be considered?
Only if I can tell you why Fraser too, and I will. So
thank God.
So I think we touched on this earlier. Like, I think Beyonce had a lot to say that was outside kind of the narrow voice that she was allowed to have in Destiny's Child.
Okay.
I think one thing we've said is that if you're going to break away from a group and say that not only did you deserve this one place in musical fame, but you deserve a second place just for your voice, you better damn well earn it.
That's fair.
And I think Beyoncé's earned it. I think she's put out stuff that is compelling, that's independent, that's her voice, that's become, you know, hallmarks of a generation.
Wildly popular.
And it's stuff that would never have happened if she hadn't had the hubris to leave Destiny's Child.
Absolutely.
You know, hubris is fine as long as you earn it. You know, it's only bad when you're writing checks you can't cash. And Beyoncé cashed every fucking check she wrote, in my opinion.
Just quick clarification. Hubris, as it being identified as such, is always bad. I mean, if you're talking about pride, I just want to throw that out there. Hubris means you're going to fall. Hashtag Greek. All right? So
now I'm going to talk about Frasier, because fuck you.
All right. I earned that. I earned that. Okay, go on. Yeah. You were going to say Don Henley, and we all know it.
I don't even know who that is. Is that the guy from Mad Men?
That's Donathan Draper.
Donathan Draper. No, I mean, all I want to say is that, you know, Frasier managed to highlight on some of the tropes of Cheers, the wife who was never present in a room.
That's not a trope.
Yes, it is. It's a fucking trope.
It's
a gag. Fine.
That's not what a trope is.
It's a gag. It's a trope. Okay
a trope
I think it's really funny that, you
will
know,
they, won't they,
you know,
Sam and Diane. That's a trope.
Here's it. Will they, won't they, Daphne and Niles. So here's what you got to know about doing a podcast with Mike is that his degree of anal retention varies directly with his whether he likes the subject matter you're talking about. So just, you know, as a co-host of this podcast, I'd like to issue a warning to all future co-hosts. Color within the lines, or he's going to fucking come down on you like a bag of hammers.
No, I think you were going to bring up Frasier regardless of everything.
I know, but I'm talking about the flux of your anal retentiveness.
In what capacity?
This podcast.
No, of course. I didn't say parameter.
I'm just saying, I used foil pretty loosely earlier, and you didn't clamp down on me.
Right.
But I did, you know, play it fast and loose with hubris and with trope and gag, and you clamped down on me.
That's like, because, you used foil correctly.
In my opinion, I used foil fast and loosely.
Yeah, but it was correct. Like, you used hubris correctly before, and then you said you just got to own hubris. You can't. You'll die. That's what happened to all the people with hubris.
I feel like you're trying to make this into a hubris conversation instead of a conversation about why you brought up the hubris conversation.
Can I just bring up that I didn't argue, or I won't even edit out how much you talked about Pink. So, I think, what does that classify as?
I already agreed that you would edit nothing out from this entire podcast.
That's not a... Yeah, you can agree all you want,
the people
guy.
Have a right to this.
All right. Anyway...
All right, so Beyonce, honorable mention, Frasier.
All right. So I picked Jack White. And, I mean, the White Stripes is pretty much Jack White. And then he could play the drums better than Meg White. I think Meg White was there just for, like, companionship. And
he actually plays the drums for other bands. He plays drums for Dead Weather. He plays the drums for a couple of things.
I know he was in Dead Weather. I didn't know he played the drums. I mean, he's had side projects. He did the Rock on Tours. And Dead Weather, of course. So the White Stripes, that was sort of Jack White just before he decided. I think he wasn't comfortable enough playing on his own. I don't know. But he put out a CD on his own called Blunderbuss, which is awesome. You actually introduced me to the songs inspired by the movie Cold Mountain. That was everything he does on that, where he sings like old folk songs and then some of his own stuff. It's just, it's not only beautiful, he puts his own spin on it and shows just how incredibly creative this gentleman is. So I think I actually had to look for that one, because every time you look up important solo acts who went on their own, it's like, oh, this guy from New Kids on the Block, it's, or Joe Jonas, or, you know, somebody from the Cheetah Girls.
The Cheetah Girls?
Raven Simone?
The Spice Girls?
I don't know. No, the Spice Girls are all on there too. I didn't even consider Jack White as the solo guy, because he's always in my head. It's just like, he's always doing everything, and Meg White just stopped playing drums, I guess. I don't know.
One person I thought to bring up before I settled on Bay is Lauryn Hill from the Fugees.
And then you could also say Wyclef Jean from the Fugees, but I think Lauryn Hill
also as well. But I think the Miseducation from Lauryn Hill is such a compelling, refreshing departure from her work with the Fugees that
she definitely stood out more. Where I think Wyclef sort of wandered into more pop territory where she was much more comfortable standing up, putting out stranger stuff.
And I think Wyclef was a much bigger part of the sound of the Fugees than Lauryn Hill was. I mean, she was kind of under a bushel, and then she kind of came out swinging.
That's a really good example, too. I just don't know enough about her to throw her out there. Okay, great.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Toss salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged.
So we're going to do some plugs. Dave, are you a presence on social media that you want to share with people?
I occasionally share musings through my Twitter account.
Okay.
It's ADGREGG. That's at ADGREGG.
Cool. All right. This has been Comparing Apples to Oranges. Today we looked at solo artists who came from a group. Thanks for listening. This is Mike.
And Dave Gregg.
We're signing out. Thanks for listening to episode 4 of the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. Look us up on Tumblr. We are Comparing Apples to Oranges, all one word, .tumblr.com. That's where all the links for my co-hosts and info about upcoming and past episodes will be. Any comments or ideas for future podcasts, please send it to. Our Twitter handle is The Cato Podcast, all one word, or you can email us at catopodcast@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music with a couple of the sound beds was Thumbs Up by a great artist named Leisure B. If you like that and want to check out more of his stuff, go to humanworkshop.com. All right, thanks. See you guys later.